Yes, and thank you, Jim. It's very special because we may get many quantities of other things, including nearly a dozen symphony performances that we get to bring you in the course of a year. But only once or twice a year do we have fully staged opera happening in Spokane, and that happens because of Inland Northwest Opera, which is opening its season with two performances this Friday and this Sunday of an opera by Gluck called Orpheus, take it whichever you want. And Eurydice is the way we've been saying it on the radio, but as we're learning, the more correct way to say Eurydice. And we're going to meet those two main characters of this opera very soon, along with the conductor, to kind of do what conductors do, which is tie everything together. But on the way into that, I do want to mention, as I do with all performances, the protocols that are being in place. It is in the Fox, as I mentioned, Friday night and Sunday afternoon, and that means that the vaccination cards are required or proof of a negative test within the previous 72 hours. And as an additional caution, Inland Northwest Opera is only selling every other row, so you'll have a lot of nice space between you and the other patrons. It should be a very relaxed way to feel comfortable and spacious in the Fox for this opera production. So with that said, I've been pleased to be kind of paying attention to this for a few weeks, including the good time we had last week with the stage director Dan Miller and Dean Williamson, our frequent guest here, the conductor. Hello, Dean.
Hello, Vern.
Can we even describe the name of the year when you first showed up in Spokane and started conducting here?
I believe it was I got the phone call from Spokane Opera about 2001, summer of 2000 or 2001, because I had just made the switch from being principal pianist in Seattle Opera to starting to conduct, and was looking at an empty calendar of, and what am I going to do with my life? And all of a sudden, Spokane Opera called with one of my first conducting offers.
And so we'll call you the conductor of the new millennium. And on the way into that, and you certainly have, because now you are conducting, you alluded last Wednesday, you're conducting Rheingold here sometime this season, right?
Yeah, and I'm music director in Nashville Opera, and I still live in Seattle and kind of conduct all around. And so I'm doing my, finally, after playing the Ring twice in Seattle as a pianist, I get to conduct my first Ring opera, Das Rheingold, next spring.
And Spokane has this maybe not so great habit of being really happy when somebody maybe was first here and then they've gone on to other things. We have such names as Thomas Hampson and such to put into that category. So we feel really good about, you know, you as one of our own. So welcome back.
Thank you very much.
And so this opera by Gluck, and we talked about it last week, we have two singers with us today. So go ahead and just give us an overview of the two characters that they play as the primary, you know, the opera's named after the two of them.
We have mezzo-soprano Emily Fons, who is doing Orfeo. And then we have soprano Emily Bersan, who is doing Eurydice. And this is the classic tale of Orfeo having to go to the underworld to rescue. It's one of these so-called rescue operas that became very popular at this time. And so they'll be doing two excerpts, two short arias, and a duet from the show.
And so it's, what's it called in the business, a trouser roll? Was it called that when it first happened?
I don't know exactly where that term came from, because it's one of those crazy roles that went through the entire vocal cycle of male, female. People were trying to figure out what to do with it. So, and in the first version, it would have been a castrato in the Italian version in Vienna. And then in Paris in 1774, they didn't like castrati there. So, of course, their favorites were what they call these super high tenors that the French only had. So he rewrote the piece, changed all the keys, moved everything up, and then when that fell out of fashion, and then they were going to redo it again, Berlioz actually reorchestrated the whole piece and did his own version. He preferred the version that we're doing, which is the original Italian version from Vienna. So he was the one that suggested to some mezzos, you know, we should give these to a mezzo-soprano and then move the key back down there. You do occasionally hear it done by a regular tenor in the Paris version, but sometimes you have to adjust the keys, and they'll go between the Italian version but sing it in French in the Italian key. So this piece is very famous around the world for, I jokingly call it a Frankenstein monster, because everybody does a customized version, because we have so many versions of this piece as done by Gluck and Berlioz out there. So you can basically do a, you know, mix and match modular and customize what is best for your cast and your needs.
But it is a great legacy of mezzo-sopranos doing male roles so specifically, and famously Mozart and Strauss both
did that. It really is, and I believe it probably started the tradition. Well, we know by Nozze di Figaro, a few years after this piece, the Marriage of Figaro, that Cherubino was a trouser role, a mezzo, pants role, we call it. And then nowadays, it's become fashionable sometimes to give it to a male soprano to go back. So it's a double play on gender, and it gets very confusing.
Well, anyway, let's get right to our studio, because in our studio we have these two brilliant singers, Emily Fons as Orpheus, and very few arias in this, but there is an Act One aria. So tell us just a bit about this before we hear it performed.
This is her first aria in Act One, and it's strophic. What Gluck tried to do was do a much simpler. He regressed from how opera had become so convoluted with the characters and the plot, and so florid in the vocal writing. And this kind of came about the same way with what was happening in music in general with the Rococo period, to kind of back off the fanciness of the Baroque. So what you'll notice about this is the very simple musical line, and it's just a beautiful melody. It's very short. It's in three verses. We're going to do the first verse. And then she's going to do a little bit of the accompanied recit that's right after this. So you'll get a chance to see what this is like. And then she and I can talk a little bit more about how that is so special and so different.
So we'll go to the studio. Mary Trotter is at the piano. Emily Fons singing this Act One aria from Orpheus and Euridice.
Oh.
and a recitative, first act aria and a recitative from Orpheus in Euridice, sung for us by Emily Fons, Mary Trotter playing the piano on that. And even before we bring in Emily, one question about the keyboard part, Dean. You mentioned that there is a little bit of recitative in this. So are you the conductor doing the harpsichord, or is Mary doing
this? This is the unique thing about it. It's early accompanied recitative.
Oh, it's all
accompanied. So it's all strings. Oh. So the strings have to function how I normally do at the keyboard when I do my Rossini and Mozart operas. And it's very interesting. What makes it so easier for us is that the string parts have the vocal line in it. So they can basically, it's like chamber music, and they can follow along. And they have to do it about as free as with the harpsichord. So it's not very strict in that company.
Yeah. And so Emily, thank you for that gorgeous singing. I've heard about you, and yes, it is all true, of the sheer beauty of your singing. So welcome to Spokane.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me today.
Have you done this role before?
I have not. No, this is my first time.
Oh, that's good. And so there must be all kinds of discovery and excitement, because I assume, if I can presume, it's not only that, but then there's this sense of liberation of probably coming out of a long isolation and back to performance, too.
True. You know, it's funny that you say that, because I was thinking what I wanted to kind of say about the role today. And, you know, with any role, you prepare by yourself at home, right? Yeah. So it's kind of a lonely process of preparation. And then you get with everybody and it feels a lot less lonely, because all of a sudden you've got, you know, scene partners and other people on stage. And this role was kind of interesting in that way, because, yes, on the one hand, with COVID and everything and coming out of, you know, a lot of distanced performing and all of that, it does feel really good to be back with everybody. But then I'm doing this role where I'm alone so much of the time, and then I can't even look at Euridice when we finally do share the stage. So it's a very odd kind of accumulation of different emotions, I guess. Yeah.
Almost as if COVID had taught you a particular behavior that you would need in the operas.
Yeah, something to social distancing from Euridice. Yeah, I guess.
But anyway, let's bring Dean back into this and talk just a little bit about what is going on with you at this moment in the opera when you were singing this and in this aria. So lead off on that and then come in on that, Dean.
Sure. So this is the first time you really hear Orfeo sing much. He comes in kind of calling out Euridice's name during the first chorus. And then this is kind of a moment where he finds himself alone. He sends the chorus away. You know, he says, you know, your mourning is just aggravating my own feelings, so please leave. And he finds himself alone. And he goes back and forth between singing about kind of his own feelings about Euridice, how he's calling out to her. And then he, as you heard, it was kind of a melody and then followed by a little bit of an outburst of recitative. And it kind of goes back and forth between those two types of singing. So he's just kind of examining his own feelings about calling out to her, and she's not there. And he asks the heavens, he asks the people on earth and to help him find her, to help him reach her, and nobody is able to do that. So it's kind of the first time you hear him contemplating his own grief and calling out for his lost wife.
I also find what's so interesting about the orchestration in this is that he uses a double orchestra. So the three verses are based around three verbs: chiamo, I call out; piango, I cry for; and cerco, I look for. And those are the subjects of each of the three verses. And what happens is that you it's hard to hear on the piano, but in the orchestra you'll hear in both the aria and the recitative, this echo effect, which is a small sub-orchestra, and it would have been placed backstage using the shalomo, the original medieval instrument. Now we place it with a clarinet or a flute. So you hear that, I call out for her, and I don't hear any, and he just hears his voice coming back, just the echo of that call out. And so Gluck was very sensitive about this, but he does it so simply with so few notes, you know, and that's the amazing thing about this score.
And so having set up pretty much the character of Orpheus, let's move on to the character of Euridice. And so we have an aria coming from there. It's much later.
This is in Act 3, and it comes at the point, anybody who knows magic flute and Pamina Zari Akishfus, which is the same journey where Tamino can't, you know, he can't talk to her, and she's like, "What's going on? Why are you not talking to me? You're ignoring me," you know, and she's so upset she has to sing an aria. So that was Mozart's version 30 years later. So here is the original version. We can almost call this, like, you know, ground zero of this sad aria. So she's basically, che fiero momento. So she has, basically, it's her frustrated outburst. And you'll see the music is much more intense. It's in C minor. It's she's upset and wondering what's going on.
So let's go back to our studio. And again, Mary Trotter at the piano. And this time, another Emily Bursan as Euridice, singing this aria from the third act of this opera. From our studio, that third act aria from Orpheus and Euridice, that's sung for us by Emily Bursan, and again joined by pianist Mary Trotter. So we have both Emilys in the studio. We have both main characters of who are the titles of this opera in the studio with us. Last week, when Dean and Dan were in, we talked some about opera historically moving from entertainment to deeper meaning, and the ways that we've depended on opera to really tell us things about what matters in life. And I think this story has a few of those. I'm going to make kind of a low-class observation for you to both respond to. In terms of the cliches of the genders, we have the idea of the taciturn guy who never tells his wife anything, and then we have the wife who is needing the kind of assurance and such as a standard cliche of our civilization. And I bring it up because that's very much what was going on in Magic Flute too, when you were suggesting, Dean, that this was kind of a precursor to that place in Magic Flute. Do you agree with anything that I said, either on the kind of funky level or on a deeper level of what this opera is trying to say about relationships between men and women? Well, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, there is that stereotype of the woman wanting affection and the man not really able to be giving it. But I do think we have and explored deeper on the crux of when you have an argument with someone you love and the resentment and all of the other feelings that come behind that when you actually do love that person. So the fact that I am completely wanting his love, but I get to a point of go ahead and don't tell me you love me, and almost anger and resentment over time. So we had a good time playing with that, not just I'm a victim, please love me, please tell me you love me. So I do think that the music is telling us those things, and it's our job to kind of go a little deeper and round out these characters even more.
And Orpheus, your reaction to the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, I would have to agree with Emily that I think that's what we've been trying to play against a lot of the more obvious themes, even musically and dramatically in the opera. And while it is true that, you know, Orpheus isn't answering her, he's not giving her what she needs, he's also agreed to that, you know. So I think his frustration in the moment is maybe what we can focus on instead of the fact that he's not, oh, typical. He's, you know, he's stonewalling. He's not answering. You know, he's so frustrated. You know. And we've talked a little bit about, too, how what he's doing is, you can look at him as like, oh, he's being a hero. He's going and getting her back. But we've kind of examined that, too, of what do they both actually want? And is what they both want selfish? Is what they both want giving and loving? It's, you know, so there's some nuance that we've been able to go into that I think is interesting beyond the kind of the more obvious gender stereotypes.
And Dean, your thoughts on that?
I agree completely. I think that opera, from its inception, tried to look at universal themes. If you go back to the original Orfeo, Monteverdi, 1607 or something like that, they tried to look deeper and try to find these universal themes. And so our job as performers nowadays is to find that relevance for a modern audience, both in my job as a musician in terms of making the music accessible and meaningful to a younger audience, and their job as actors to find the universality of that emotion in that. You know, as Perry Lorenzo, our beloved education director at Seattle Opera, used to say about opera is like the school of love. Opera is a school of life, and life lessons, love lessons, are universal for all of us.
Yeah. And then these are certainly the dominant two figures in this opera, but not entirely the ones. There's a character role also in this opera. Tell me about that, whoever wants to.
The character of Amore, sure, the I guess you could say goddess / in our production maybe demon who comes to, you know, Orpheus's aid, quote in quotes. We don't know if she's really helping or not. And again, this is our take on it, our production, you know, maybe different than other productions people know about or have seen. But Amore comes and offers Orfeo the deal. You know, she says, okay, you're gonna be allowed to go alive into these places that other people haven't been able to go alive, but there's going to be some rules, and you got to stick to them. And the rule is you can't look at her, and you can't tell her why you can't look at her, you know, which is maybe the more complicated aspect of that, you know. And so she's there actually almost the entire time on stage in our production, kind of creating situations, causing things to happen, bringing Orfeo and Euridice together at the end, but it's not all as harmonious as maybe we'd like. So, yeah. And our colleague Jocelyn plays her beautifully and is having a lot of fun with it. Yeah.
And then the chorus, too. But even before I mention that, if you've just joined us, we're talking about the opera, which is this Friday night at 7:30, Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at the Fox. And so now what about the use of the chorus in this?
The chorus is really fantastic because they become all of the other peripheral characters. So in the first scene, they're a bunch of mourners, and then they become all the characters in the underworld. And it's similar to what Handel did in The Messiah, especially in part two, you know, where they become all of the various elements of that entire story. So it's not just a static Greek chorus that stands and comments on the action. They're actually actively involved. And they're singing, they're dancing in our production. It's really quite amazing and quite beautiful.
And does your production have an abstract or an obvious time sense? Is it set in now or in 2,000, 3,000 years ago, or just in terms of staging and costumes and that feeling?
Sure. I think our designer was aiming for kind of a 1950s feel a little bit. So definitely modern and updated. Mm-hmm. But the clothing, you know, will probably speak to people of the 50s, 60s era.
So it is making it relevant for now. And then what about the dancing? Because there is some choreography involved.
There is choreography involved. And we have artists from Spokane, which will be fantastic. We have four dancers, three women and one man, and they also become part of the characters. We've been able to add in extra music from the French version. So we add the longer Dance of the Furies to end Act One, and then we do the famous B section with the flute solo, the beautiful flute solo from the opera that a lot of flutists, including Jean-Pierre Rampal, used to always play it and recorded it. We'll do that to open Act Two. And we have a lot of dancing and ballet that occurs around that. And so it's very beautifully incorporated seamlessly into the entire production. And the chorus gets a lot of movement as well. So sometimes you can't tell, okay, who was the dancer, who was the chorus person. And it's, you know, I think Dan has done a really, really beautiful job of, you know, trying to integrate all of this with the music and with the soloists as well.
Nice. And as you mentioned last week, of course, super titles so that there's no issue for anybody that's in the room of knowing what's being said and why.
And I think what is wonderful about this piece, because it is so pared down, and this is actually the 1762 version is the most streamlined version of all of the versions of this, all the various editions of this opera. So the pacing goes at a natural conversational speed. So it's not going to be like if you're in the audience, you can't keep up watching the surtitles and looking at the stage. It's a very comfortable pace and a very natural, organic pace.
Of Orpheus and Euridice, which is, as I mentioned, 7:30 on Friday night and 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, a date which shares itself with something else that happens later that night. But Halloween will take care of itself.
We have some spooks on stage.
Yeah, there you go. And then we're on our way in a moment into a final duet. So since you're both in the room, tell us a bit about this duet that you're going to give us as a closer to today's radio version of this.
I think this duet is when they come back together and he's leading her through the parts of the underworld where he can get her out. And we've come to a point where I've realized, wow, he's really can't look at me and I'd have no idea why. And I think at this point she's saying, just leave me alone. Just let me go back to heaven, because that was a way better life than where you're leading me now, which I have no idea. And I love you so much and you can't even look at me. And so I imagine this is the time in a couple's life where you're just both banging your heads against the wall, just not knowing where to go, what to do.
Perfect. Well, right now where to go is out into our studio to treat us to this duet. The two members of the cast who have been so beautifully illuminating this opera for us is Orpheus, Emily Fons, and as Euridice is Emily Brassen. Again, Mary Trotter at the piano for this duet from Act 3 of I think it was from Act 3, right?
It's Act 3.
From Act 3 of this opera. So I think they're about set. So duet from Orpheus and Euridice, sung for us by Emily Fons and Emily Brassen, Mary Trotter, the piano. So there's some good preview things of the gorgeous singing. I was going to be done right now, but I want to bring in Dean Williamson for one more little detail, and that is it lovely cosmic luck that the two voices are so beautifully paired, those two voices?
No, it isn't, because they're also great friends, and they've sung together a lot. Actually, we've all worked together. Emily Fons and I just did Cenerentola in Atlanta before the just in the pandemic, and then we just did it this right after the pandemic in June in Nashville, and then Emily Bierson did Violetta for us in Nashville. So, and then the two of them have kind of studied and worked together in the business quite a bit and are such close friends. So it's a wonderful chemistry. Dan, the director, and I have done, this is our third time working together. So it really, there's a lot to be said for chemistry of bringing people, the right people together on a project so that, you know, it's like when you plan a dinner party or cocktail party, you're very careful about trying to find your friends that will have something in common.
Well, congratulations on the casting to you, and certainly to the people from Inland Northwest Opera, and for this great casting. Once again, Friday night at 7:30, Sunday afternoon at 3:00. One can simply Google Inland Northwest Opera, and you'll find all the details you need about that. And I think that's all we need. My thanks to Jim Tevenin for the engineering, and certainly to all these great performers for performing for us. Last week, we heard a little bit of this. Let's hear a little.